Well, good morning, friends. Good morning. Let's begin with a word of prayer. God, you have drawn us to this place and to each other, to your word and to your church. Lead us anew, teach us anew, show us who you call us to be. In the name of Jesus, we pray. Amen. So just to begin, as a review of last week, we spent some time thinking about the Good Samaritan parable and thinking about various aspects of that story. We thought about, and I was here thinking about what stuck out to me in my own teaching, but maybe there are other themes that stuck out to you, but I was struck again by vulnerability as a neglected thread on the Good Samaritan story, that so often we think about the go and do likewise, we think about the tangible things we're all supposed to do, and sometimes not think enough about the different levels of vulnerability seen in that story, but also the different levels of vulnerability that we have among ourselves as we walk through the world. Second, I thought about how the Good Samaritan and the man left for dead are not boundaries for inclusion, but a trajectory. They're not the farthest reaches of our neighborliness, but they're an arrow. They're pointing us to say, beyond the Samaritan, beyond the person left for dead on the side of the road, there are an untold number of neighbors as well to which God has called us. I thought third about the weight of the question, who is my neighbor? A question that the lawyer in the narrative doesn't mean fully. It's kind of a half question, a challenge to Jesus rather than an honest question. But that in this season, we're tackling it, I think, we're trying to tackle it as an honest question. Who is my neighbor? And that so often, even in our own approaches to that question, who is my neighbor, the temptation is always there to constrain the response, to limit the response. And even as God is calling us to widen the scope of who we imagine our neighbors are, our tendency is still to kind of draw in more and more. And last, I was struck by the last thing that Jesus asks the lawyer to do is to go and do likewise. And the complexity of the go and do likewise. What does it mean to show mercy? What does mercy look like in our everyday experiences? So I wanted to turn to you as well to see if there are stories or encounters or moments when the light went on for you or you thought of a new question as you thought about the story of the Good Samaritan as we begin. And I'm going to here have some spousal, what's the word I'm looking for? Spousal privilege. Because Holly and I talked about experience that she had right after church last Sunday, and I was hoping she would share a little bit of that story, and then maybe one or two others might be able to share as well.
Sure. So I had a walking partner for the last several years. Many of you in this room know her, Corey Berg, and I have spent many hours walking all over Princeton, and one of our favorite spots to walk was the Institute Woods. And we spent much time walking there together. And one Sunday afternoon, about a year ago, we encountered a young couple. They looked like they were in their 30s, very fit people. And they were assisting an elderly gentleman who was clearly in distress and disoriented and having some intense physical symptoms. And this young couple didn't seem to know what to do. And so Corey and I, church ladies, jump into action and start assisting. And throughout this encounter, we both were very surprised that this younger couple seemed so perplexed about what to do, particularly when we learned that the man was an ER doctor and the woman was an EMT. And we didn't, and they were physically much larger than both Corey and I. They were very tall and physically fit people. And this gentleman, the older gentleman, needed physical support. And
you say one more, like Corey was sitting back to back to him.
So yeah, it was me. I was sitting back to back to him. And at one point, Corey is on one side of him, you know, trying to support this gentleman. And we physically weren't quite up for this task. Eventually, this gentleman, we were able to get him connected with paramedics, and he was able to get assistance. We still talk about him and wonder what happened to him. But as we talked about it later, just wondering, what was going on with that couple that they were so uncomfortable helping and that they didn't seem to know what to do? And we realized one of them shared with us at one point that they weren't from this neighborhood. They were from somewhere in North Jersey, and they thought it was a scam. they thought that this older gentleman was somehow a plant, and that they found this situation kind of threatening. And what I realized after our conversation, particularly about vulnerability, is that Corey and I, despite not having that professional knowledge and training, and despite being physically smaller, we did not feel vulnerable because this was our neighborhood. This was our place, our town, and we knew what to do. And we're like, well, call, you know, we just had a sense of comfort in our environment that this couple, despite seeming like they should be comfortable, they just weren't, and they felt really, really vulnerable. So we were thankful that we encountered them, and hope that that gentleman is okay.
The story come to life. I love these kinds of stories. Ross, please, yeah. Oh, here comes Holly, because I think we're recording.
Thank you. When you were telling that story, my first thought was maybe they were concerned about liability. And that was the case in a lot of states that a medical professional could be held liable. And then I guess they passed what they called Good Samaritan laws in a number of states to address that issue. So I was thinking about that. And the other thing I was thinking about from last week was the famous case that you all all probably know. I don't know if you mentioned it, the Kitty Genovese case in New York and Queens.
Oh, no, I didn't mention that.
That was a horrible stain on New Yorkers because this poor woman, people in a building heard her screaming for help, and they didn't want to get involved, and they did nothing, and, she was murdered, and it was a horrible stain on New Yorkers, and I think so much shame was felt. That was, I think, it happened in the 60s.
Yeah. So the bystander effect, right? The sense, too, that somebody else will take care of this.
Yes.
I know one person who is not affected by the bystander effect, and they're standing over there.
Right.
Always jumping into action.
Yeah.
But I think for many of us, the sense that somebody else will step in. And I think, did we talk about the university experiment with the seminary students? Did we mention that last week, the Samaritan experiment? No? We were talking about it afterwards, Carol. There was this famous experiment done in the 50s, 60s, maybe, where it was folks at the university doing a study on empathy. So they had seminary students prepare sermons on the Good Samaritan text. And they had them come over to the university and told them, okay, now you're going to go over to this other building, and there you're going to deliver the sermon. And between the building where they started and where they were going, they had an actor pose as someone who needed assistance, someone who needed help. And the question was, will the seminary students who have just read this text, who are preparing to proclaim it, will they stop and help? The other wrinkle, which made the difference, is that they told a third of the students, don't worry about it, you have plenty of time. They told a third of them, you have to rush over there, you're late already. And the other third, they didn't say anything about whether or not they were on time or not. And who was the most likely to stop were the folks who were told they had plenty of time. That sometimes, and here Nate Stuckey was preaching on this text recently in chapel and talked about the way that urgency can close us off from seeing our neighbors. But then he went on to another step and he talked about also that sometimes urgency is quite necessary. So sometimes there's these moments when we have to jump into action. We can't just take our time to do that as well. So these stories come to life all around us. Please, please.
So I was driving on Sweetbriar. Do you know Sweetbriar between Trenton and Hamilton?
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. There's no sidewalks. There's partly a muddy creek there, and there's a bridge that goes over the muddy creek. I was driving on Sweetbriar to my gym in Hamilton. There was a woman with a 4-year-old, I later learned, and a 2-year-old, standing on this little bridge over this muddy water. And I thought, what is going on here? Why is there a young woman out here with 2 children? So I made a U-turn, and I stopped, and I said, do you need help? She said, yes. I said, okay, get in. She got in. She was walking from Hamilton to the Social Security office in Trenton with 2 children in tow. Okay. Her children hadn't eaten, and so I gave them money and put them at the McDonald's, which she wanted to go to by the Social Security office. And she said she would walk to the Social Security office after her children had been fed. I said, well, I'm going to the gym, and I'll come back in an hour and get you. I came back in an hour. She got back in the car. I said, where do you want to go? And she said, I'm in a motel on Route 130. The Mercer County put her in this room. I said, okay, I'll take you there. So I took her there, and those three people are living in this one little motel room, a little shabby motel on 130 south of Hightstown. And I said, what else do you need? And so I gave her money. I told my brother about it. He sent me some money via Venmo, and I gave her some more money. And then I got her food, and she wanted organic cleaning supplies. So I told my husband this, and so we went to Walmart and got her organic cleaning supplies and took them to her. We went out of town. I texted her a couple of weeks later, said, how are you doing? What do you need? No answer. And that's fine, but I wasn't threatened. There's no way I felt that this one woman by the side of the road with two little children was going to hurt me.
Mm-hmm. What I love about these stories, they're just these reminders that these... The Good Samaritan story, the way it works is because it resonates with our everyday experiences, because I think many of us have had these experiences either of stepping in the moment, or sometimes these stories where we wonder why we'd step in the moment and we wish we had in the past. This happened last week. Hold on. Do not disturb. Okay, great. So it's about these stories coming to life among us, and that these stories, any of these stories that we just shared, don't have simple morals. There's complexity in the story about who knows the area and who doesn't know the area, who feels comfortable and who doesn't. And there's always bigger questions that we will never know. Were they concerned about health insurance? Why did this woman not respond to your text? The stories are more complex than it seems on the page. And so the stories aren't calling us to get to an easy answer at the end, but instead to imagine the possibilities of who is God calling us to be a neighbor to in our world. So today, we are moving to the story of the Gerasene demoniac in Luke chapter 8. This is one of many stories of exorcism in the New Testament, and I thought the first place we should turn to is think about the demonic, which should be fun among us, right? Think about this. I think many folks struggle with these stories of exorcism in the New Testament. In New Testament scholarship, especially 19th and 20th century, after the Enlightenment and we all got smarter, people had really, they figured they had solved this notion of exorcism and also of Jesus' healings, right? In the case of exorcisms, that these are people who had mental health challenges and that Jesus was able to counsel them or draw near to them. And a lot of the healing narratives were like, it can't be that Jesus healed them because we know that doesn't work. It must have been that these folks had a psychosomatic disease that Jesus was able to compel them out of that experience. But I want us to come close to those assumptions for two reasons. One is that we're shaped, I think, in the West by Enlightenment notions about what's possible and what's not, about science and the supernatural. I think we're also profoundly shaped by pop culture. And although I've never seen the movie The Exorcist, how many of you all have seen The Exorcist? I've never seen it, but I know enough, like living in this culture, and I've seen enough images that when I think about these stories, I think about, you know, quotes and pictures from that movie. And so for us, on the one hand, it becomes this supernatural thing that we don't believe in anymore. On the other hand, this thing that we have to go to movie theaters to experience. So that's where we find ourselves, and that what constrains often our ability to interpret this text. And on top of that is that if you spend any time in the rest of the world, these kinds of experiences in other parts of the world are everyday and common. This is how many of our neighbors throughout the world imagine and come to understand the world. And we can sit on our perch up here in the West and kind of look down upon that supernatural assumptions, or we can try to come to understand what is it that's being named here, what is it that's being experienced here, and maybe that they're not things in our own world that are identical to it in our own Western worldview, but ways that are parallel to these demonic forces that might help us understand how people are feeling and experiencing these demonic forces, these demonic invasions. So here we might think about, what is it that's happening in these stories of exorcism in the New Testament? What happens in these stories? Well, you have these invisible forces that can invade people and communities. And what do these forces do is that they deal in death and destruction. It's particularly true in our story today, as we'll see, is like that's the character of these forces. And no one knows where they've come from, and no one knows how to get rid of them. There are these forces that are dealing with death and destruction in our world, and we don't know where they came from, we don't know how to stop them. And this is why Jesus is so extraordinary in the Gospel of Luke in particular. In Luke chapter 4, Jesus, the first exorcism and healing that he does is to exorcise a man full of unclean demons, which is hilarious to me that Luke calls it unclean demons, as if there's some clean demons out there. There are organic demons, right, that out there. I think it's like Luke doubling down on this description. But he rebukes this demon, and the people are amazed at the authority of his voice. And right after that, Jesus goes to Peter's house and heals his mother-in-law who had a fever. And using the very same language, it says that Jesus rebuked the fever. That the demonic and illness, at least in Luke's imagination, they're kind of not identical, but they're interwoven. Nobody knows where they came from. Nobody knows how to stop them. Nobody has that power. And again, people are amazed by the authority with which Jesus speaks. And I love to point out to my students that this is not a description of the caliber of Jesus' voice. It's not because he sounds like James Earl Jones, right? That's not what people are amazed at. What they're amazed at is that his voice does something that nothing else can do. It can rebuke this demonic force. It can rebuke this fever. And so we've got these forces that no one can control except Jesus, that no one knows where they came from, that wreck death and destruction in our communities and are invisible. And we might wonder if there are forces like that amongst us. I think of a whole list of isms that continue to haunt us. These long historical realities of racism and misogyny and homophobia. They're not identical, but there are these forces that seem invisible to us. We don't know exactly where they came from. We don't know how to address them. We don't know how to make them go away. And yet they wreak death and destruction in our midst. Maybe there are ways that we are also experiencing these kinds of forces in our circles as well. And last is often, you know, and we saw this in kind of modern New Testament scholarship and still today, is an association with demonic forces and mental health disorders. And I think that can be helpful to a degree, right? To help us to conscientize ourselves, to create some empathy for folks wrestling with mental health in our midst, especially folks that we see sometimes in the streets who are not able to be housed. But that's only helpful to a limit, because I worry that if we associate mental health disorders with the demonic, that too easily those two things become identical. And we're worse off than when we first started. So a complicated set of ideas, but less complicated is what I think these healing stories and these exorcism stories mean for Luke and for Jesus. In Luke chapter 4, Jesus declares that the Spirit was moving and that the poor will have the good news proclaimed to them, release to the captives, recovery of sight to the blind, to let the oppressed go free. These are the promises of God that are being fulfilled in Jesus' life. They are what salvation looks like, feels like. We talked about this a couple of Lents ago, the shape of salvation in Luke. So these moments of exorcism, these moments of healing, are not just fireworks that Jesus does so that people are amazed and they come and hear the good news. They are the good news taken flesh. So that when the formerly Gerasene demoniac is walking around in the world, he is the gospel. He is the good news that God brings liberation. But that's the end of the story, and we will get there. So I think here's where salvation and our neighbors intersect. So let's read the story together. So this is Luke chapter 8, starting in verse 26. Then they arrived. So this is Jesus and the disciples. They arrived at the country of the Gerasenes, which is opposite Galilee. As he stepped out on land, a man of the city who had demons met him. For a long time, he had worn no clothes, and he did not live in a house, but in the tombs. The story happens right after Jesus calms the waves. Remember, they're in the boat, and he's asleep, and the disciples are fretting about what's going to happen to them, and Jesus can control this watery, death-dealing chaos. So one thing to understand about many Israelites in the first century is that the Mediterranean Sea and other bodies of water are places of chaos and destruction. It's where boats go to sink. It's where Leviathan, like sea animals, live there. It's a force of death. So much so that in the book of Revelation, when the New Jerusalem comes down from the heavens and comes down and describing the city, the Revelation talks about the things that are not in the city. There's no grief. There's no tears. There's no sadness. I'm all for these things. Apparently, also, there's no ocean in the new city of Jerusalem, which, as a Puerto Rican, I find deeply troubling, because a place with no ocean is not heavenly. But it's about, there's no death in this place. There's no grief, and therefore there's no ocean. So Jesus has controlled this watery chaos before, and then he arrives across on the other side here. For the first and last time, Jesus is in a Gentile area in the Gospel of Luke. Otherwise, he's always around Israelites. This time, he is in a different place. We meet this Gerasene demoniac, who quite literally is the walking dead. He lives among the tombs. He lives among the dead. He walks around in ways that are barely human. He has no clothes. He has no house. So he is the very embodiment of chaos, of the forces of death, of all that we cannot control but that we dread. In short, here we're running into another unlikely neighbor. And so when Jesus calls us to go and do likewise, what does mercy look like in this story? When he saw Jesus, he fell down before him and shouted at the top of his voice, "What have you to do with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I beg you, do not torment me." For Jesus had commanded the unclean spirit to come out of the man. For many times it had seized him. He was kept under guard and bound with chains and shackles, but he would break the bonds and be driven by the demon into the wilds. So here we hear more of his condition, his neighbors keeping him under guard, keeping him under chains so that he would not hurt himself or others, and that even those chains, even those shackles could not hold him, and he would be driven out into the wilds. When the man responds, "What have you to do with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God?" I wonder who it is who is speaking here. Is it the man? Is it the demonic forces? Are they so interwoven that we can't tell one from the other? And I wonder, too, when he says, "I beg you, do not torment me," who is speaking there? Is it the demons who do not want to be left out, like expulsed from this body? But I wonder more and more if it's the man himself. So here's a person who's lived under a state of subservience, a state of control. And despite our thinking about individual freedoms, I think in the first century, a lot of folks imagined themselves as part of a larger hierarchical society. That in a sense, you're always enslaved to someone. You're always in service to someone. Unless you're at the very top of this chain, unless you're Caesar, there's always someone above you. And so I wonder when he sees Jesus, whether it's the demons or the man or some combination of the two, they see the power of Jesus. They hear his voice, the authority of his voice. They know that he can control them. And I wonder if the man himself is wondering if he now is going to be enslaved to another new master. Do not torment me. I know what it's like to have a power over me. And I wonder if the Gerasene demoniac worries that he's not going to be liberated, but switch one torment for another. That he sees in Jesus a dangerous power. Again, the situation of the man is made further evident at the end. He is characterized by the control others have over him. He has no independence, he has no agency, and maybe he can't imagine that he would ever have independence again. Maybe he never had it in the first place. Jesus then asked him, "What is your name?" He said, "Legion," for many demons had entered him. They begged him not to order them to go back into the abyss. So notice the pronoun changes here. Before it was he was speaking, now they are speaking. I think even the grammar itself is confused about who is it that's speaking here? Who is it that has authority? Who is it that has agency in this story? What is your name? And again, who is it that's responding? I think I'd always assumed up before this week that it's the demons responding. They're taking in and saying, our name is Legion. And Legion, of course, is a name for a Roman army. And for some scholars here, there is a sense that of the demonic force that's represented by Roman warfare and Roman violence. So think back to Luke chapter 4, when Luke's account of Jesus' temptation happens. The devil says to Jesus, I'm going to show you all the kingdoms of the world. And of course, what does Jesus see but the Roman Empire? And then the devil says, all this power has been handed over to me, and I give it to anyone I please. Worship me, and this will all be yours. What is that except an invitation to rule over the most powerful empire the world had ever seen? And it suggests to me that for Luke, as evil as the empire might be, behind it is a larger force. So I wonder here, that's part of the imagination that's being called for us. But it's not they said, it's he said. Is this the name that his neighbors had given him? He no longer has a name that his parents gave him, but he goes by the name that everyone points to him and says, Legion. That's who you are, Legion, Legion. It's his whole identity. Because so often in scripture, when people are asking for someone's name, it's not just a matter of identification, but a matter of identity. Tell me who you are. Tell me who your people are. And here he's identified entirely with this demonic force. His name is Legion. And so the demons here, they see the force, the power that Jesus has. And they can know that they cannot stop him from exercising them. But they ask for something. They asked not to go back into the abyss. And here when these texts are imagining the abyss, it's a watery place of chaos. It's a place of death and destruction. That's what's being imagined here. Do not order us back into that place. We want to stay here. Now, there on the hillside, a large herd of swine was feeding, another marker that we're not in Israelite area. We are in Gentile area. A large herd of swine was feeding, and the demons begged Jesus to let them enter these. So he gave them permission. Then the demons came out of the man and entered the swine, and the herd rushed down the steep bank into the lake and was drowned. Here, notice Jesus' authority is named. He gave them permission. He gets to control these forces. And notice, of course, the irony of the request. The demons say, don't send us back to the abyss. Don't send us back to the watery chaos. Don't send us back to the place of death and destruction, but they can't help it because this is what they do. They drive, whether it's pigs or a man, they will drive them toward the abyss they wanted to avoid, to a place of death and destruction. This is what they do. They cannot do otherwise. So when the swine herd saw what had happened, they ran off and told it in the city and in the country. They told everyone. Then people came out to see what had happened. When they came to Jesus, they found the man from whom the demons had gone, sitting at the feet of Jesus, clothed and in his right mind. And they were afraid. Several times, Luke is going to identify we still call him the Gerasene demoniac, which we really shouldn't, because several times here at the end of the story, it's not the Gerasene demoniac, but the man from whom the demons had gone. It's a whole lot of Greek words piled up together. It's not very economical. It's a mouthful. And yet Luke will go out of his way. Here, we'll see it again here in a second. The man from whom demons had gone. He is not Legion anymore. His former identity is no more. Now he is the man from whom the demons had gone. And what is his characteristic is that he's sitting at the feet of Jesus. He's clothed and in his right mind. This is a new identity that the man receives. But I think also for Luke, it's a reminder that the exorcism is complete and it's irrevocable and irreversible. Legion is gone. Now it's the man from whom demons had gone. And you would think this would be a cause for celebration, because here this dude was walking around, and we have to keep chaining him, and he keeps breaking the chains, so we have to make new chains. He keeps threatening himself and others. This should be a celebration, but they are afraid. And the question is, why are they afraid? This is a good thing that just happened. Let's see what the story says. Those who had seen it told them how the one who had been possessed by demons, there's that whole awkward phrase again, the one who had been possessed by demons had been healed, is what the NRSV says, but the word here is the same Greek word that's used for saved. The man who had been saved. Then all the people of the surrounding country of the Gerasenes asked Jesus to leave them, for they were seized with great fear. So he got into the boat and returned. I think healed is a fine translation of that term, but I'd rather hear we think about the man being delivered, being saved, being liberated. Often in the gospel accounts, the notion of healing and the notion of salvation are mapped onto each other. He is saved from these demonic forces. And here again, we can return to this question of why they are seized with great fear. This is the second time that Luke tells us that this is the characteristic of their response. And I've come to think that the reason that they're afraid is that as long as these forces of evil were contained in one person's body, and as long as we could mostly control them with chains and shackles, and as long as we would mostly isolate those forces among the dead or out in the wilds, then those forces would not come and visit our family and those who we love. It's as if we could contain evil in one body, and then we wouldn't have to worry about it too much. It's a bit of a hassle to chain them up, but maybe then evil is contained. But now those evil forces have been let loose, we're not quite sure what to do with that. What if they come back? What if they return from the abyss? Even worse, what if Jesus' healing of this guy is temporary? What if we let him back into our homes? He seems okay now, but maybe he's going to go right back to who he was before. I mean, we all know his name is Legion. He's not the man from whom demons had gone out. His name is Legion. And they are afraid that the order of their world, the order of their safety, the order of their community was being challenged by this Jesus who's coming in and telling them something different than they've always known. And I wonder, too, if there's a parallel, not exact, between the request from the town for Jesus to leave and the request that the demons made. Not that they're identical, but that there's a parallel. That while the demons drive themselves into the abyss, the story of this community and this newly liberated man is not over. The story about how they're going to live with one another is not done quite yet. So the man from whom the demons had gone, there's that awkward phrase again for the third time, had gone, begged that he might be with Jesus. He wants to be a good disciple. He's asked people before to leave their nets, to leave their jobs, to leave their families. Sometimes people come and ask Jesus, just let me go bury my father. And he's like, no, we gotta move. Here this guy is ready to go with him. And of course, he's had this identity that he cannot leave behind. People will see him and only see who he was before. Let me go with you. But Jesus sent him away saying, return to your home and declare how much God has done for you. So he went away proclaiming throughout the city how much Jesus had done for him. Here again, we have this ideal disciple. Let me come with you. Let me have a new start, a new identity, a new name. Let me serve new people. Let me tell others what you have done for me. But he tells them that no, he must stay. And we wonder why, and it may be because that community needs to know that they too have been exorcised. That the demonic force was not just harming this one person, but the whole community. Their integrity, their way of being together was harmed by this force. And although it was just in that one man's body, the whole community had bent around the presence of this evil. They too needed to be healed. They too needed to be exorcised. They too needed to know that they were safe. And so he goes back, he proclaims, he tells the good news. And I wonder, what is it that the former demoniac, this man from whom the demons had gone, what is it that he says? Maybe he says, demons have no authority here anymore. The chains you once used on me are no longer necessary, for I am a new person. Or better, I am who I was always meant to be. A beacon of good news, of life, liberation, and not the walking dead. And I wonder if he's announcing these good news to these people. It's like, it's not just about me, it's about you too. You no longer need to live in the fear that I once caused. I'm struck also by the easy identification between God and Jesus. Jesus tells him, declare how much God has done for you. And here, the former demoniac, the man from whom the demons had gone out, is proclaiming how much Jesus had done for him. This close identification between these two forces. So who is my neighbor in this story? We can think about this a million different ways, but a few came to mind for me. First is that my neighbor is the one who disrupts the order we have grown to love, the order we have grown to need, maybe even the order that we have come to worship as an idol of safety, of calm, or of order. And so what does mercy look like for a community that has forgotten that it's love that makes a community, not safety? Second is my neighbor is the one who previously saw me as a threat, as a danger. What does mercy look like when a community has gotten used to chaining someone else up in order to protect themselves? And again, we find ourselves here thinking about questions of vulnerability and also unclear answers. What is the go and do likewise here? Is not a simple equation between those individuals in our community that we fear, that we are afraid are dangerous to us and to others. It's not an easy mapping from this story onto ours. It's not as simple as equating Legion with those demonic forces still wrecking our communities. But I think it does require some renewed imagination, coming face to face with the necessity of neighbors who once seemed to threaten us, but whom Jesus has now liberated. And perhaps in the liberation of those who were previously demon-possessed, in their exorcism, we find out not just who God wanted them to be, but we also, turns out, we find out who God wanted us to be as well. That it's not just about the Gerasene demoniac, it's about that whole community. And it's not just about how we imagine demonic forces around us and the way that Jesus might liberate those individuals captured by those forces, but about when those people are liberated, when those people are saved, what does that do to us? How does that change our own sense of community and belonging and who a neighbor is? All right, I talked way too much. Questions, thoughts? What did you notice in the story? What did you see that you're still wondering about? What resonates for you? I think right in the front.
What I find astonishing, or maybe it's not so astonishing, is that the community was comfortable with the chaos of the demons.
Yes.
And they preferred the chains, even though they were not reliable, to the authority of Jesus' authority given by God. That seemed to scare them more.
Yeah.
And that, you know, it's and I can think of modern parallels, but I won't say. But I mean, the chaos and hate as opposed to love is sometimes preferred more in a community.
And for us to think about why we would prefer that. Why would we prefer that kind of chaos and hate? Perhaps because it seems controllable, and when it's gone, we don't know how to relate to one another anymore. We don't know how to relate to people who were our former enemies. When would they become our neighbors? I think that is, again, challenging and raises all these questions of vulnerability. So I think that is really striking. And I wonder, too, I hadn't thought about this, but the man from whom the demons had gone does not really demonstrate any act of faith, doesn't ask for Jesus' help, doesn't say, Jesus, if you want, you can help me. He says, do not torment me. And so where is the faithfulness there, right? Is the faithfulness maybe of what he was able to do in his liberation and not so much what he was constrained from doing before? But I think you're right. I think our preference for chaos is one that we can imagine in our own lives. And I think it's worth reflecting on. That's really smart. Thank you. Two hands here, I think. I don't know who was first. I don't remember. So start with Frances here.
Thank you. Well, we talked in group this week about how, for instance, when someone is recovering from addiction and goes back to their family is skeptical. Mm-hmm. And we see that in this story. And I also think that when he went around town proclaiming the good news, they thought he was just as crazy.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so in this story and so many others in Luke, we don't find out what happened afterwards. Did people receive it? Did people think he was invaded by a different demonic force? And he's like, oh, he's still off his rocker, right? That's super interesting. I hadn't thought about that. I think often these stories are left open for us so that we might reflect on what do we do when Jesus comes in and messes with our sense of order and then he leaves? Do they go right back to calling him Legion, or do they identify him by his new name? And I wonder if that puts it back on us. And I think it's fascinating to think about this mapping on families dealing with individuals with addiction, because so often the reason that they don't want to believe it is because they've seen it before, right? And what is it, the best indication of future, was there, you know, is past performance or whatever, like when people show you who they are, believe them, right? That's often advice that we give one another. So it's hard to imagine that people can change. And here, this isn't just a matter of addiction, but just, you know, we all have those friends that they keep promising to do different and they keep treating us in the same way. And so I think that's another form of this, is that we can't imagine that people would actually change, because so often they don't. That's worth thinking about. I think there was a hand up here, Holly. Yeah, and then, great. Here comes the microphone so we can get it on tape. Right behind you. Thank you.
You just said what I was thinking.
Good.
That sometimes it's not, it's fear of change.
Yeah.
Fear of change for the community.
Yeah, absolutely.
As well as fear of change for the individual.
Yeah. It's almost worse at a communal level,
right? We're comfortable with
mm-hmm.
what we know.
Yeah.
And change is a fear.
It's very, really hard. There was a thought that came. Where did it go? Oh, no. Nope, it went away. Okay, please.
Yeah, thank you very
much.
Thank you very much. So I'm giving my cross-cultural perspective
now.
Having coming from the Muslim context and serving as a pastor for more than 20 years, and when you are in a Muslim neighborhood, so mostly people sometimes come, even Hindus come for a prayer in a church. And they are not wondering what your faith is, because they believe that something's going to happen, they could be delivered here.
Yeah,
like my recent article published in PCUSS Journal, Psalms and Interfaith Dialogue in Global Context. So there's, I mentioned a story last year, I was in Pakistan, and the Presbyterian Church, it's one of the largest church where we have more power encounters. And it's famous for that power encounters. Presbyterian Church, more than 100 years old church.
Wow. Yeah.
And the pastor was my junior in seminary. And I mentioned in that article, because I was in that service with my few professors, guests with me in Pakistan. And they attended that service. And you can believe there's a video I posted on my page also, where all this crowd, and they were right as they start singing Psalms. And then there was, which we called the moving head.
Yeah.
And they were moving like a real wind. And they were pulling back, coming toward the pulpit.
Yeah.
And that's where the pastor was rebuking.
Yeah.
So we as non-Western, in that context, we are part of that regular culture where these incidents are a part of a regular worship and a regular power encounters.
Yeah. Yeah.
Concerning Western context, we have seen that. I think Paul Hiebert's mentioned that excluded middle. When we talk about the Western Enlightenment, the concept of the top and the bottom, and they totally miss the middle excluded in the Western understanding.
Yeah.
So that is, I think, a few aspects. Concerning that when Jesus said to him that you stay here, I see it as a missional perspective. As a missiologist, I see that was, which today, mostly, in the Western context, we give name to everything. Whatever we saw over there, and we bring it here. So I think this is a kind of a missional model which Jesus showed as like a staying in a homogeneous group. Stay there. And that's a powerful story also in the mission history in India and Pakistan.
Yeah.
When the mass movement started, And the mass movement not started by the missionaries. That was started outsider, and the guy came to Mission Center, and he said to Andrew Gordon, actually, and the Presbyterian pastor, and he said that, "I want to baptize." And I said, "Who sent you? And how did you heard about us?" He said, "I heard a preaching in the bazaar, and I came here, you baptized me, but I don't want to live in the Mission Center.
I want to go back
to my people." And they were astonished, because generally, first generational convert, you keep them in a Mission Center just to grow as a community. So these are various aspects, I think.
Absolutely.
As a part of the last comment on the chain and the people fear. I think when people doesn't know, as you mentioned, that structure of Roman Empire, but we see also that organizational chains and the bondages, like our doctrinal bondages and our church structures bondages, does not allow us to engage in the uncharted territories.
So I love this last point in particular, to think about what are those dynamics in our communities that constrain us from seeing the power of God's liberation, right? In that case, it's imaginations about the power of the empire or how the demonic has moved in this community. But there are other ways that, whether it's doctrine or dogma or organizational assumptions, that can sometimes constrain us from imagining God's liberation. And thanks also for this kind of first-person perspective, because I think this is more common among Christian communities in the world than the experience that most Westerners have. And I think to know that this is the larger dynamic doesn't mean that we have to kind of change our minds about what's happening, but we can't just close off possibilities that others are experiencing and just dismiss them out of hand as superstitious or anything like that. I think we have to grapple at a much deeper level with these questions. And I remember what I was going to share here. I remember I was teaching on this parable of the prodigal son once, and I was at a church, and there was a couple there who had a child with addictions, and said, "You know, if we do what the father did, we're just going to enable our child." It's like the opposite of what you're supposed to do in those cases of addiction. When they come back, you don't throw a big party for them, right? There's levels of accountability. And to me, it's a reminder that whether it's this story or the story of the prodigal son, these are not simple morals where it's telling you what to do in every situation. Again, it's about the imagination these stories evoke. It's about how it helps us think about these chains that are binding us and about the way that demonic forces might be moving in our midst. Marvelous. I think we have time for one more, maybe? Or we need to, one more. And we can talk after.
Is this the only gospel that this story appears in?
No, so it's also in Matthew. It takes on a kind of slightly different shape, but it's not the only one
there. Two things occurred to me. One is that I read this in the King James Version, and the response of the either the demon or the man is, "What have I to do with you?" So the pronouns are reversed, and I love thinking about it that way. It's almost scornful. You know, "What have I to do with you, Jesus?" And I can't think of anything to say about it, but it just, it's fun to think about it that way. But the thing that struck me about this, and this came up in small group, what stuck out when we read through it was, "What is your name?" And it took me back to when we sat in this room several weeks ago with the man who came to speak to us about how to deal with someone who's obviously in distress. And the first thing you do is identify yourself and ask what the person's name is. And I just, that has meant so much to me, reading this and then thinking about that in my own life.
That there's a moment of recognition that I think can calm people down, but also I think in this story, maybe in that case too, there's asking people to identify themselves. And here he's identifying himself with these forces that have invaded him, and Jesus is, in a sense, going to give him a new name and a new identity. Marvelous. Thank you, friends. Go and do likewise. We'll see you next week. No, I won't be here next week, but the week after, we'll see you there. So I think...
Next week, we're going to have Ned speak to us. Ned, I'm going to hand over the mic real quick. Can you give us a one-sentence synopsis of what you'll be talking to us about?
So I'm mounting a show of work, of street photography I've done in Grand Central Terminal. Over the last 10 years, actually. And there's going to be a show of that work in the conference room. And I'm going to talk about that work and how my interpretation of it changed in the context of Who's My Neighbor.
Thank you. That sounds like a beautiful interlude in our series. Everybody, we'll see you next week. Thank you.